You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of April 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
The United States and the world reflects on half a century without Martin Luther King. My guests Daniela Peled and Brian Klass will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including US President Donald Trump's big idea for militarizing the Mexican border, US President Donald Trump's other big idea for baiting China into a trade war, and as two South Australian police officers nearly find themselves a Great White's lunch, we'll discuss our own close encounters with marauding fauna. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24. 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Peled, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Brian Klass, Fellow in Comparative Politics at the Department of Government at the London School of Economics. Welcome both. And we will start in the United States, where President Donald Trump has found time in between golf and tanking the stock market to return to his weird, morbid obsession with his country's border with Mexico. With work on the much-vaunted border wall proceeding slowly, almost as if Trump has no idea how to get anything actually done, he has now announced his intention to deploy America's military to secure the frontier. The extent to which he might have discussed this with America's military in advance is unclear. Brian, first of all, in fairness to Donald Trump, both Bush and Obama did send the National Guard to the border at various points, as did the state of Texas. Is that what Trump means, or do we think he means something more dramatic?
Nobody has any idea. I mean, I don't know if the military was aware that he was going to announce this. I don't know if anyone in his administration was aware that he was going to announce it. It seemed like one of those things that's a throwaway line. And there's, you know, increasingly you have these stories where, you know, they get debated and discussed and then they come to nothing. So I think first off, we should say this may never happen. The second thing is that there's no real pressing concern that this would be addressing. Net migration is to Mexico from the United States now. So there are more people going from the U.S. to Mexico than coming from Mexico to the U.S. That was happening before Trump became president. And it's unclear exactly what they would do. I mean, they have a huge amount of now digital technology, infrared sensors, all sorts of things that are much more efficient at patrolling the border than sending a bunch of human beings to just wander around in the desert. And so it just seems like one of these other things that Trump is doing to sort of send a signal to his base that I am going to do what I said. I'm going to still be committed to building the wall. And, you know, it fires up those people who may be faltering in their support for Trump for other reasons.
Daniela, sending human beings to wander around in the desert has been a cornerstone of U.S. policy on a number of fronts for some years now. It is the evergreen question where Trump is concerned. Does he even mean any of this at all, or is this just one of those things where words have popped into his head and so he said them?
Words have popped into his head and he said them, but he's used a very, in some ways, a quite clever shorthand. He's talked about sending in the National Guard. Well, that's shorthand for, oh my God, we have a terrible crisis and we have to deal with it. That means that migration from Mexico is a disaster, potentially like a hurricane or a terror attack or some kind of mass weather event. That's what he's saying. Therefore, the National Guard is shorthand for some sort of slightly hysterical response. Of course, it doesn't make any sense. There are, I think, 350,000 reserve members of the National Guard. You could pull them all out for the day and have them wander around the border. I'm not sure what good that would do. And of course, if America was under real danger, real threat that the National Guard was needed for, that would take them away from addressing that. He is yet again making some off-the-hand, off-the-cuff remark, which his advisers and indeed pundits and the whole media are rushing to kind of rationalise and pick apart as if there was some sort of strategy behind it. And I think we are, again, giving him too much credit. I wonder, we should really get out of the habit of doing that.
Brian, is he panicking slightly, possibly, at the prospect that, you know, come even certainly as soon as the midterms in November, it is going to be demonstrable that not one brick has been laid atop another in terms of building this thing that he's been talking about for years?
Yeah, so I think that there's this $1.6 billion that's been allocated. Most of it will just be to repair existing wall, some potential new fencing. And he's trying to really rile up the base. But I think that we should see this through the lens of what Trump is doing on virtually every front, which is the reality show Smoke and Mirrors presidency. It doesn't really matter how many people from the National Guard go, if any of them go. It's about signaling to the base. So people from Trump's support base will say, look, he said he would send them to the National Guard. That means he's taking it seriously. He said he would build the wall. That means he's taking it seriously. If there's a photo of one guy in an army uniform in front of an existing piece of wall, Trump will count that as a victory, and his base will tweet that photo till their heart's content, and they'll say, look, you know, not like Obama, who did nothing about the border, which, you know, is obviously untrue. And that's the entire name of the game here. I think the other thing that's really dangerous about the rhetoric Trump uses with border control and immigration, etc., is a tweet from today, for example. He said that Democrats just want open borders and people to pour in unchecked, which not a single member of Congress would agree with that statement. I mean, it's obvious, right?
It would be a bold platform to campaign on.
Exactly. But I mean, you have to say this because there is a significant part of the American population that when they talk about Democrats now, they say all these people just want unchecked migration. They want anyone and drugs and all these things to flow in without any checks whatsoever. And it's just not true. But this is why Trump, in his sort of smoke and mirrors presidency, is poisoning this discourse around American democracy. And at the same time, you have these little photo shoots that then they claim as victories, and nobody pays attention long enough to realize that there's no substance behind it. And that's why he gets away with it, and part of the reason why he still has 37 to 42% support in virtually every poll.
Daniela, should we be expecting anti-immigrant rhetoric from Trump to increase broadly in proportion to the descent of the Dow Jones Index?
I think we can expect it to increase because that's something that he's relied on consistently. I mean, that is absolutely part of the platform as such. It plays to his base. And immigrants and migrants and refugees are very useful people to blame. And what Trump has very handily, just as we have in the UK, where the Brexiteers are blaming the Ramonas for trying to stymie every move they make towards leaving the European Union, Trump can just blame the wreckers and the people who are not supporting him and the system, which is what he's done so far quite successfully, blame them and blame them and blame them, and therefore doesn't have to take any responsibility for his lack of achievement.
Well, let's move along somewhat, because sticking with the thoughts of Chairman Trump, he has also today taken the come and have a go if you think you're hard enough approach to China, vis-a-vis what appears to be an escalating trade war. After China imposed tariffs on another 106 US products, including cars, aircraft and soybeans, Trump responded, when you're already $500 billion down, you can't lose, which may explain, if nothing else, how Trump is one of the few people ever to have lost money running a casino. Brian, another famous Trump quote, of course, with which you're doubtless familiar, with his declaration that trade wars are good and easy to win. Is he at this point lulling China into a false sense of security before he springs the trap?
I think you're giving him way too much strategic thought here.
It's a thing I like to do sometimes. It's fun.
Yeah, there's a lot of things to unpack here. So first off, the U.S. is not $500 billion down. Even if you were to say that a trade deficit meant you were down, the trade deficit is $375 billion. He uses the $500 billion all the time. Give or take $125 billion is sort of a big deal. In addition to this, you know, China is really smart about how they're responding to this, and Trump is really stupid about how he's crafting the policy. So China's announcement today was to, one of the main things they said that they were going to put tariffs on was soybeans and cars, right? Cars are one of the economic lifebloods of Michigan, which was a swing state that, you know, defected basically from being a blue state to a red state, helped swing the election to Trump. And of the 10 top 10 soybean producing states in the U.S., Trump won 8 of them. And the 9th, Minnesota, is a swing state for the House. And they're going to get screwed by this. I mean,
it's almost as if there's some sort of pattern.
Yeah, well, China has figured out that they can basically, you know, really stick it to Trump's base and make this politically uncomfortable for him. They're smart about this. They're also, by the way, putting stuff. This is sort of like how the European Union put on tariffs on things like bourbon and motorcycles, knowing
specifically
that,
Harley Davidson's, which I thought was a cute touch.
Yeah, and it's because Paul Ryan is from the Speaker of the House is from Wisconsin, where they make Harley Davidson, and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, is from Kentucky, where they make bourbon. So, I mean, Trump is dealing with people who play, you know, diplomatic chess for a living, and he's sitting there playing checkers and thinking that he's going to outsmart everyone and win this $500 billion trade war, which is, you know, itself a lie. But he's, you know, it's moronic foreign policy that's going to really hurt some people who don't know better who voted for Trump.
Daniela, do you detect any particular method to Trump's madness? Has as far as it's possible to tell, which is always a big asterisk where Trump is concerned, does he know where he's going with this?
I think, as we've just discussed, with the border wall, he comes out with some crazy, and I say, use the word advisedly, crazy plan. And then his advisors and his teams are tasked with seeing if there's any possible way this could be enacted or maybe made even slightly plausible. I believe his top economics advisor said that actually this isn't about trade war. This is negotiation, but using all the tools available, which sounds an awful lot like war being the continuation of politics by other means. No, what's going to happen if this, what's already happened, we can see the stock market, this affects markets globally. And it's not to say, just as there are issues with migration that need to be addressed, there are issues with Chinese trade practices that need to be addressed and that should be addressed. But in the using the chess analogy, there are multilateral ways of dealing with this, thinking about the consequences of each move. Multilateralism is not one of Trump's favorite things. He wants to take this kind of flag waving, crazy, as I'll repeat that word, approach unilaterally. It can't work. There's no way this can work.
Brian, as you correctly pointed out, China does appear to be deliberately whacking Trump's base by way of response. But from just a pure domestically political point of view, is there a chance that that actually kind of works for Trump? It plays into his narrative of a world that's out to get them and how no one is speaking for them but him. Or do you think there is the vaguest chance that any of these people, that irreducible 37% that you mentioned, are going to start to wonder if maybe Donald Trump might be at least part of the problem?
So I think there's a core of Trump's base that no matter what he does, will stick with him. And I don't think that's 37%. I think that's more like 30%. I think he's going to risk that sort of seven.
That's still a heck of a lot.
It's a heck of a lot. No, I agree with you. I mean, I'm astonished by this, and I think it's an amazing feature of the Trump presidency. But I think there is an unshakable base of probably 30%. Then there's like 10 to 12% that goes with him when things are going okay with the economy, but could defect if they don't. And I think those people could be affected by this, because what really is going to happen is there's going to be a trade war that hits certain aspects of Trump's base, but a lot of it is going to hit the broad aspect of sort of working class American consumers who have to deal with higher prices. And they're going to notice these things over time. You can't hide that and say it's fake news when your bills go up or when your costs of things go up. And so that's going to hurt. And also the other thing that's going to potentially really damage him is if this trade war happens at the same time that the Republicans lose the House, because, you know, this could well continue into November, all of a sudden the Republicans are going to realize that Trump is a sinking ship and they ideologically disagree with him. Almost the entire caucus of Republicans in Congress are free traders. And they've built their, people like Paul Ryan have built their career on the idea that free markets create prosperity. So I think he's playing very dangerous political brinksmanship with his own party and with people in his base who are going to be hurt by this. Now, of course, you know, there are people who will say Trump is the Messiah, and no matter what he does, they're going to vote for him. But that's not the way you win elections. It's not the way you hold onto the House, and it's not the way that you maintain a governing coalition. So, you know, with 30% of the country behind him, he will be a dead-in-the-water president, which is he's not when he has 40-plus percent, which he does now.
Daniela, do you get the impression that the Chinese, like I suspect the Russians, are at this point basically laughing themselves to sleep every night?
is yes too short an answer?
if you could elaborate somewhat.
I'll elaborate a little. I think that there are many, many actors on the world stage that, if not laughing themselves to sleep at night, have been emboldened by the reality they can act almost with impunity. Certainly the Russians, although to be fair, President Obama did quite a lot to fuel that phenomenon as well. But as you know, as Brian said, this is Trump acting like a child and his interlocutors acting like adults. It's as simple as that.
Brian, you did mention that thing about Paul Ryan and the rest of the GOP panjandrums who have spent their entire life as absolutely dogmatic, ideological, not to say headbanging free traders. And it is a question I've asked you in various circumstances at various points over the last few years. But is there any chance that this is the thing that causes the acquiescent GOP leadership to just go, OK, that's enough?
Amazingly, I don't think so. I don't think so beyond words. And they actually could do something about this. There's you know, a way that the Senate could effectively rein in Trump's ability to unilaterally make trade policy. And they should do that. I mean, I think it's so dangerous to have somebody like Trump just shooting from the hip with international diplomacy and international trade. But at this point, they're so close to the election that they probably realize that splintering the Republican base is a surefire way to lose the House and possibly the Senate. So I think they're almost like these hostages where they figure, you know, they look into the camera and say these things that they do not believe at all. but then they understand that if they don't do that, then their base will have depressed turnout and the bad situation they have now is going to get much worse. In addition to the fact that, and this is my favorite statistic about explaining why, you know, these sycophants who don't agree with Trump back him at every turn while they rip their spines out and just, you know, say these horrible things, is that the average margin of victory in House races in 2016 in the U.S. was 37%. So Republicans have to fear a primary challenger. They do not have to fear a general election opponent in most of the races in the country. And that means that if you don't back Trump, somebody on the right will challenge you. You might lose. If you do back Trump, you're not going to lose the general election unless you're in one of the sort of 50 to 75 swing states that might be in play. Most of them are not. And so that means that whatever Trump does until November, they're going to back him. If there's a landslide in November, they might actually break with him, and then Trump's presidency will take a radically different term that would be very, very bad for him, whether the Democrats take both the House and the House and Senate or just the House.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Peled and Brian Klass. Coming up next, Martin Luther King, 50 years later.
Monocle's April edition kicks off in a golf buggy in Indonesia, where President Joko Widodo takes us on a tour of the palace grounds and talks hardline groups, upcoming elections, and wanting to create 10 new Barleys. As our biannual fashion and retail special, it's also one of the sleekest issues of the year. We sit down with Angela Arendts, Senior Vice President of Retail at Apple Inc., to discuss how Apple stores can remedy our growing sense of isolation and profile the bricks and mortar players shaking things up in our retail survey. Our Style Top 50 counts down the brands and looks to covet this spring, plus laments the frayed fortunes of US clothing manufacturers. Elsewhere, we sing the praises of Canary Island wine, visit Dakar's burgeoning art scene, and check out the best in Scandi design at the Stockholm Furniture and Lighting Fair. Plus, we make merry with the glassblowers and woodbenders in the Czech Republic. Monocle's April issue is out now. Do get your copy or subscribe at monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Daniela Peled and Brian Klass. 50 years ago today, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot dead at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. He was 39 years old. His immense legacy is not easy to distill, but even those whose pro forma tributes today might have been somewhat grudging would hopefully concede that King asked, in his signature gospel cadences, questions to which the United States and the world in general is yet to furnish satisfactory answers. Daniela, it is really strange to think that he could quite feasibly still be alive. He would be 89 years old, and yet he does, I guess, seem kind of like a creature from myth at this point. I mean, it's an unanswerable question, for which apologies in advance, but what might have been different had he lived longer?
Well, if we look at the lives of great leaders cut short, I think what you inevitably think of when you look at the lives of leaders who weren't cut short, is that they're not sort of stuck in stasis at the pinnacle of their success. People go wrong. People become too old. People take unfortunate signs. There's very few international figures that manage to traverse that journey from being a freedom fighter to a statesman, for instance. I think Nelson Mandela did fairly well, not least because he stopped holding power at some point. But if you look at similar examples like Yitzhak Rabin, who was held up as being, you know, the hero of the left and of the peace process in Israel, although you could also have a different reading of that. We don't know what would have happened had political expediency meant that had he survived, had he not been assassinated, Oslo might have just turned out the same way. So the same thing with Martin Luther King, I guess. But it is strange to see him being applauded by people whose public statements are otherwise quite bigoted. And it's very hard as a Brit to see, to fully understand the role he plays in the American psyche. But it does seem rather wonderful that you do have these historical and national figures that people can unite around, even if the stories they tell are perhaps still quite simplistic.
That question, Brian, of the position he occupies in the American psyche, you can now speak for your entire nation, who, of course, as we have been discussing famously, are in complete agreement on absolutely everything. But is it possible to quantify that, the role he does now occupy in modern American, not just politics and historiography, but mythology?
Yeah, so one thing that's really interesting to note is that when there were public opinion surveys about approval of King when he was alive, he was very unpopular. Even at the time of his death, it was in the 20s, his approval ratings among the U.S. public. I mean, obviously because of severe racism. When the question's asked these days, it's like 96-97% who have a favorable opinion of him. And I think that there's a national holiday. There are schools named after him. He is this mythological figure as well as rightly a renowned historical figure. There's a statue of him on the Washington Mall and plaques on the area where he gave the famous "I Have a Dream" speech. So he is really this unifying figure of the idea of the aspiration of American racial equality. Now, at the same time that I talk about the aspiration of American racial equality, there are still schools that are named after Robert E. Lee too, right? There are still schools that are named after Confederate generals who endorsed slavery. So this...
Still a bridge named after Edmund Pettus.
Yeah, well, but you have this very ambiguous aspect where everyone wants to think about America in America. Everyone who's in America wants to think about America as this melting pot and this myth of American equality. And it's a myth. And I think that's one of the things that we have to recognize on a day like today is that, yeah, Martin Luther King had a huge role in advancing the cause of racial equality. But there are reports out this year that show that inequality between white Americans and black Americans is at roughly the same level as it was in 1968. And so there's a huge amount to go. And the final thing I'd note, there's a great line in a New York Times op-ed today by Al Sharpton, who marched with Martin Luther King and saw him the day before he was shot, where he says Americans hate marchers but love martyrs. And I think it's one of these really poignant points where his life being cut short did give him this mythological status, whereas now we have, you know, sort of the basically subsequent movements, things like Black Lives Matter, and they're reviled the same way that King was when he was alive.
I mean, on that subject, Daniela, we've seen the sort of pro forma obsequies tweeted today by both Donald Trump and Mike Pence, too. Politicians, I think it's fair to say that King would have had certain difficulties with. I mean, has he become, not, and this is obviously no reflection on King and his work, but has he become kind of a cop-out? He's safe now. So somebody like Trump or Pence can, you know, acknowledge him, but there's not going to be any kind of difficulty or repercussion.
Well, of course he has, but any figure on which there is a consensus, you could say, has become a cop-out. But I think it's very, very positive that there are figures like that that people can rally around. It's not very fashionable to say this, I guess, but countries need their own mythology and they need their own narrative and they need historical figures. A country which is still relatively young, like America, has been through quite a trajectory of from the slavery era and onwards. I think it is again, it's kind of wonderful that new mythological figures can be created. And just the very fact that, as Brian said, there is this massive consensus around seeing Martin Luther King as a positive figure, I think that's quite impressive, without saying that they're denying the fact that there's massive inequality, and the fact that Obama was in the White House doesn't really say a whole lot about race in America today. It's making me sound dangerously like a glass half full kind of person, but you can interpret these things easily. What needs to be done and what has been done, and you can just see which side of that you fall on.
Okay, well, finally tonight, to something altogether more trivial, the world's media is delighting itself, not for the first time, with a confirmation of the popular misconception of Australia as a free-range monster enclosure in which it verges on the miraculous that any human survives to adulthood. Footage has been doing the rounds of South Australian police officers aboard an inflatable dinghy off the York Peninsula, having their work interrupted by about 4.5 metres of great white shark. The officers, taking stock of the situation, decided to leave Jaws 2. It wisely, I suspect, having seen the film myself. We did want to use this as a cue to ask you both about your own encounters with the marauding fauna of your homelands. Daniela, we'll start with North London.
Well, this is it. I'm a Londoner through and through, and my experiences with the perilous wildlife very limited. Although, and this is a true story, which doesn't reflect very well on me, last week I did discover a dead mouse on my living room carpet, and even more shamefully, I bribed a teenager to take it away and throw it in the bin. And that is pretty much the limit of my anecdote.
In the backwoods of the Midwest, Brian, where I'm amusing myself by imagining you grew up, were you surrounded by bears, moose, and so forth?
Yeah, so I'll tell the story about when I was my camping food was stolen by a bear.
Awesome.
Yeah, so when I was a kid growing up, my parents had a showdown with my brother over eating freeze-dried beef stroganoff.
Well, this wasn't a literal showdown.
No, right? they basically said, you know, you can't leave the campsite until you've eaten this freeze-dried beef stroganoff. And he had this, it was this famous thing of family lore that he wouldn't eat it. Then 10 or 15 years later, a bear came into our campsite in the same location, stole all of our food. We went and ran after it because we needed the food. We were like 4 days out, and we needed all the food in the wilderness. And we arrived at the bags. The bear was nowhere to be found, and the only thing left was the beef stroganoff. And my brother felt extremely vindicated that even a bear didn't eat this crap. So, yeah, that was one wild animal encounter. The other one that comes to mind is when I was doing field research in Madagascar, and I was bitten by a lemur and had to get rabies shots. And when I came back to this country and told them, the nurse did not know what a lemur was. So I have a certificate that says I have been vaccinated for rabies after being bitten by a llama in Madagascar.
Did you get that framed?
I have it in my flat, yeah.
How do you get bitten by a lemur? Did you do something to upset it?
No, there's a lemur island in Madagascar, which is basically just a place.
Not a clue in the name.
It's funny. It's a wild area, but lemurs are deathly afraid of water, and they've just found a place where the river splits and then goes back together, so it forms this natural island. They put the lemurs on there, and they don't leave because they're afraid of the water. So they just put all these wild lemurs on. They get comfortable with people. They jump down, and you feed them, and it bit me.
I mean, the lemur is, I guess, akin to the Australian possum, a preternaturally cute marsupial which does often dwell in people's roofs, for example. But the thing is, it will have you if you try to move it along. It will do you up proper. The possum, you don't want to get into it with the Australian possum.
Andrew, did the possum do you up proper?
No. I was warned from an early age not to attempt to make friends with possums, or indeed, I mean, it is the thing about growing up in Australia. It is just a general rule. Just don't pat anything. The closest I know of to the bear stroganoff incident, this happened to a friend of mine whose word I trust, was that they went to have a barbecue near Canberra, in one of the national parks near Canberra, and they left all the food out preparing for the barbecue, which was noticed by a local emu. But the emu being the emu, and they are bastards, emus. They just enjoy screwing with people for fun, with all of the barbecue preparations laid out, you know, at its mercy. The emu did not touch any of the food. It ate their box of matches. That brings us to the end of today's show. I'm serious about emus. They're terrible. Daniela Pellet and Brian Klass, thanks very much for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Augustin Macellari. Research by Megan Atkinson. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs with Matt Alagaya. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.